You can't have empire in the world and democracy at home.
Journalists saw truckloads of vanloads of Iraqi kids and women and civilians dead.
We have put out a call to all of the Code Pink groups all over the United States to contact their local Fox affiliates and demand fair and unbiased reporting of the war.
None of this is very clear. The president just asked a bag full of money to be sent down to the White House so he could run the war.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, April 3rd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A U.S. congressman blasts the president for praising the troops with one hand and cutting the veterans' budget with the other. Three British soldiers face possible court-martial for criticizing U.S. tactics in Iraq. And a look at the business of war. Who's profiting from war in Iraq? But first, these news headlines.
With headlines for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jonicky Lafice.
And I'm Daniel Costello. U.S. military sources report that forces trying to take Baghdad's main airport fought some Iraqis there today, but resistance appeared minimal. ABC reports that the Saddam airport has been captured but not yet secured. Baghdad's Saddam airport is about 12 miles southwest of the center of the city. U.S. troops said they had expected the airport to be more heavily defended. NATO Chief George Robertson says the war against Iraq must end as soon as possible and that NATO foreign ministers are moving towards an accord on post-war Iraq. He said that minimization of civilian casualties and delivery of aid are urgent issues and that the UN must play a part in post-war Iraq. The threat of an Iraqi chemical or biological attack against coalition forces has become negligible, according to a U.S. military source in Iraq. The commanding general of the 101st Airborne Division gave the order today that soldiers in the division would be able to take off their anti-chemical and biological suits as of Friday morning. The U.S. has not reported the seizure of any large caches of chemical or biological weapons, but many suspected sites have not been reached by U.S. forces. At a news briefing today, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld strongly criticized countries that were talking to the Iraqis about a possible negotiated ceasefire. Rumsfeld said, quote, "There is not a chance there will be a deal, and it doesn't matter who proposes it. There's not going to be one." He labeled the talks as notably unhelpful.
Mosques have become the latest target in a series of attacks in the Philippines. President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo declared a state of lawlessness all over Davao City, warning of a crackdown on terrorists. Binu Alex reports.
This is the fifth explosion in the last 48 hours, and the casualties have touched 20. Eyewitnesses say the attacks on mosques seems to be synchronized and planned to disrupt any hope of recovery from last night's bloody bombing. All the three exploded within an hour and all were homemade bombs hurled from speeding cars. Davao is the main city in Mindanao Island, which is the main center for Muslim minority. Moro Islamic Liberation Front, or MILF, has been waging a bloody battle for separate homeland for more than a decade now. But the MILF has completely denied their involvement in the latest violence. Observers say the attack could sabotage peace talks that are to be held soon between the government and separatist leaders. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Benu Alex.
It's been nearly 30 years since Anime Pictuaguash's frozen body was discovered in the Badlands on the Pine Ridge Reservation. A new lead has surfaced in the case. Jim Kent has the story.
The two prevailing theories for her death have been that she was killed because she was a federal informant or because she knew who the federal informant's name were. But law enforcement could never trace a lead to her murder until now. News from Indian Country editor Paul DeMaine has followed the case for a decade. He says Looking Cloud's arrest is the beginning of the end of the mystery.
This is the front end of what I call the opening page of the last chapter in this case. We know as of today that a second indictment has been issued for the arrest of John Boy Graham Patton, a individual who lives in Western Canada, and we are expecting further indictments as this case goes along.
Both Looking Cloud and Patton are alleged to have transported Pictuaguash from Denver to the location of her execution. DeMaine anticipates their arrests to lead to others who were involved in Anime's death. South Dakota U.S. Attorney Jim McMahon was unavailable for comment on the case. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent.
The trial of three Roman Catholic nuns who hammered on a Minuteman III missile silo in Colorado last fall will go to a jury tomorrow. U.S. Federal District Judge Robert Blackburn, a Bush appointee, denied today the defense's request for an acquittal based on lack of evidence. Dominican sisters Ardith Platy, 66, Jackie Hudson, 68, and Carol Gilbert, 55, cut through the fence at a northeastern Colorado site on October 6th. They also drew crosses with their own blood on the silo. The sisters have been in jail for 6 months, but Sister Ardith Platy says it has been a very powerful learning experience.
We're deeply grateful for being here and for having the kind of reverent, sacred treatment that we have been receiving. We have received thousands of letters from all over the world. So we know that the peace movement is in unity. So that's what we pray for, and that's what we'll continue to work for the rest of our lives.
The nuns are being charged with intent to interfere with or obstruct the mission of the U.S. National Defense by cutting the fence. They are also being charged with depredation or contamination of property by using their own blood to draw crosses. The nuns face up to 30 years if convicted. From Community Radio KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jonica Lafice.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Bush, confronting grief-stricken family and friends of fallen Marines, praised U.S. troops today for their two-week advance on Baghdad and said, quote, "A vice is closing on Saddam Hussein's regime. What we have begun, we will finish." Bush told thousands of cheering Marines and their families, "We will not stop until Iraq is free." At least 13 of the Americans killed in action since the war started 2 weeks ago were from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and six more from the Marine Corps base are still missing. Bush gave a speech this morning honoring the commitment of those fighting for their country. He was reminding Marines and the public that more sacrifices are to come.
In the 14 days since the major ground war began, the Marine Corps has added new achievements to its great story. On the first day of the campaign, Marine units were ordered to secure 600 Iraqi oil wells and prevent environmental disaster. And that mission was accomplished. A vice is closing, and the days of a brutal regime are coming to an end. Our armed services have performed brilliantly in Operation Iraqi Freedom, moving a massive force over 200 miles of enemy territory in a matter of days is a superb achievement. Yeah. Yet there's work ahead for our coalition, for the American Armed Forces, and for the United States Marines. Having traveled hundreds of miles, we will now go the last 200 yards. We're on the advance. Our destination is Baghdad, and we will accept nothing less than complete and final victory. Semper Fi.
According to Pentagon officials, 39 U.S. troops have fallen to hostile fire and 10 to so-called non-hostile incidents. U.S. military officials say 420 Iraqis are dead and 4,000 injured. The U.S. claims 4,500 Iraqis have been taken prisoner. President-elect Bush has just requested an additional $11 billion in supplemental funds for the war, on top of the $75 billion requested last week, with no specifics as to how it will be allocated. Peace Watch spoke with Democratic Representative Jim McDermott from Seattle, Washington, who sits on the House Ways and Means Committee today, and we asked him if he could help us to understand exactly how these additional funds would be used.
None of this is very clear. The president just sent up asked a bag full of money to be sent down to the White House so he can run the war. Most of us think there's not enough in there for reconstruction, but it's very hard to get a handle on what he's up to. As you listen to the debate, you keep coming up with the feeling that they're not telling us the truth, or if they are, they're telling it only a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm. Why would Bush propose a massive tax cut at a time when we're running a deficit and will probably incur further unforeseen expenses as a result of this war?
There's no financial reason at all that makes any sense for the president's offering a tax cut at the same time that he's prosecuting a war. I think this is a one of the most irresponsible financial things I've seen in the 30 years that I've been in government.
Many veterans from the Gulf War are complaining of illnesses that seem to be related to their service in the war. Apparently, the Veteran Administration has received 231,000 requests for service from soldiers who served in the first Gulf War. How can the Veteran Administration deal with an increase in demands for service and a reduction in funds?
Well, obviously, they can't. It's illogical to be going into a war and cutting the funds for the Veterans Administration. The president is full of good talk. His rhetoric's good, but the realities are that he never follows through.
Congressman, how is this war playing in Congress today?
Well, I think we all are hopeful that it will be over quickly and that very few of our people or Iraqis will get killed. I think people are still divided over whether we should have been there in the first place, but I don't think there's any question about our desire to protect the troops.
Is Congress likely to approve the funding that the president is asking for, in as much as there never seems to be a desire to not provide the money when the president requests it during wartime, when the troops are in the line of fire?
It's pretty hard to vote against what the president's doing, and I think that it will pass without much problem.
And several billion dollars have been cut from the budget of the Veteran Administration. Do you have an exact figure of the cuts from their budget?
I'm afraid I don't know the exact amount. I know it's a fairly sizable amount, and I think it's anything you cut out of the system is at this point wrong because it's stretched so tough.
Congressman, we have been hearing a lot of reports of civilian casualties in this war. It's very disturbing in some instances. I'm wondering if this is an issue that is coming to fore on Capitol Hill at all. Are any legislators raising questions about this? Are they hearing the reports?
The war coverage has been, from the American press, been pretty sanitized to the point where I don't think most people have a real understanding of what's really happening to people in the cities as the bombardment goes on. I think there's very little talk about it on the Hill.
Mm-hmm. Is there any chance that you might, I don't know, Congressman, introduce a resolution or something that would perhaps require that the Congress reconsider this war?
Well, I think we're so far into it now, it's very hard to conceive of a way that we can extricate ourselves in any sensible way. I just don't think there's any possibility that the president's going to back up. I think he refuses to admit he made a mistake, and that's kind of where we are.
By mistake, do you mean going it virtually alone with the only powerful ally being Britain?
Yes, the whole unilateral invasion of Iraq was a mistake. And I don't think the president's going to do anything that would lend anybody any ability to say, well, I guess he's admitted he did the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. Congressman, are you at all concerned that the American public seems to be lending their support to this war, which many around the world have said is perhaps an illegal war, if not immoral?
Well, of course, I'm sorry that the American people were not better informed about what the issues really were here. I think they have been driven by the drumbeat of war, being told that will make them safe. I don't think that's true. But I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to live through the consequences of the president's mistake.
And today at Camp Lejeune, President Bush was rallying the troops. How does one reconcile this with the cut in services for veterans?
Well, I guess he thinks that they're not as smart as I think they are. I think they can see through what he's saying and what he's actually doing in the budget. But I think that he believes that old business, or doesn't understand what Mr. Lincoln said when he said you can fool some of the people all the time and all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. I think it's going to come home to bite him in the 2004 election.
Democratic Representative U.S. Jim McDermott from Seattle, Washington. Three unidentified British soldiers have been sent home from Iraq. According to the British newspaper The Guardian, the three soldiers could face court-martial and have acquired defense attorneys. According to British military sources, soldiers can be sent home for a number of reasons, including compassionate and medical, as well as disciplinary grounds. In fact, or rather the fact that they have sought legal advice, however, suggests the three were not sent home for medical reasons. Defense editor for the British newspaper The Guardian, Richard Norton Taylor, broke the story, and he spoke with Peace Watch earlier today.
They were protesting really about the whole war. They thought it was an unjust war, an illegal war. It was partly because they were saying that amongst themselves, quite loudly and deliberately in their unit, that they thought the war was, as I say, unjust, but also partly and specifically because it was killing innocent civilians and was going to kill more innocent civilians. And they went on about this, and they were talking about how the war broke the UN Charter, and they were basically trying to, according to their commanders anyway, trying to whip up sort of anti-war feeling generally in their unit in southern Iraq, and therefore they were sent home.
Were they speaking specifically about any actions of the U.S. troops or the British troops or a combination of both or none of the above?
Well, they were talking really about the war being unjust and the conduct, the general conduct of the war, which had then already, clearly, and this was last week, and then, and they thought, will, in the future, kill more civilians, innocent Iraqi civilians.
Had they actually witnessed the...
No, they hadn't. Because, well, having said that, I'm told they hadn't, but, you know, I haven't actually talked to them yet, and they don't want to say much more, unfortunately, because although they have lawyers, the British military police here in Britain, where they are now, are reluctant, I think, or the Minister of Defence is extremely embarrassed about the whole incident. They say, I think they may be trying to play it softly, because if you have some kind of court action or court-martial, then it's going to give even more publicity to their cases, which, of course, the defence establishment, do not want. The three soldiers were in the British, or what's it called, a 16 Air Assault Brigade in southern Iraq by the oil fields there. And the Air Assault Brigade is a bit like one of some of your airborne brigades. They were paratroopers, really, and quite tough soldiers. But as I say, were basically conscientious objectors, and they were trying to stir up, I think, anti-war feeling in their unit.
So that I was going to ask you, I mean, if they felt that the war was unjust and illegal, they knew that before they put the uniforms on and went.
Well, that's what, exactly, I suppose so, and that's what the... you know, Minister of Defence says, you know, privately, they say, why on earth these guys, could they be conscientious objectors, not go there in the first place? I suppose it's possible, I mean, soldiers being sometimes soldiers and slightly blinkered maybe, sometimes lacking imagination, this is a broad generalisation here, but anyway, did not quite appreciate how the war was going to pan out. I mean, they were given, like maybe British, American soldiers too, but certainly British soldiers were giving the impression by... partly by the government here, who was concerned about anti-war feeling, that it was going to be a kind of walkover. And from word go, from the day one, it clearly wasn't going to be, as we now all know. And the British air assault people around the oil fields have since been involved in a lot of incidents, friendly fire, I might add, too, from a US A-10 tank buster aircraft, plus accidents they had, and I think that a lot of their vehicles were breaking down. Now, I don't know that for sure, but I certainly know in that general brigade they've had problems. Then Basra was a problem. It wasn't the kind of cakewalk that the British politicians certainly had said it would be. This is the port city, you know, down the south of Iraq, and you know, civilians have been killed there as they have been all the way up to Baghdad. What I don't know for certain is that they, how much they witnessed themselves, but certainly heard about it, and therefore I can't, you know, answer your question directly about what they themselves witnessed.
In terms of the reporting that you've been doing around this war, Richard Norton Taylor, how would you characterize the civilian casualties so far?
Well, course, we don't know the full scale. Obviously, the Iraqi authorities in Baghdad and Nazariya and Najaf and elsewhere have taken journalists there and put pictures, of course, of women and children and so on in hospitals and dead ones around the place in Iraqi television. That's to be expected. I think one or two incidents which did sort of cause, even more concern amongst British commanders too, actually, as well as, you know, people who watch British television, is the couple of incidents where American soldiers have fired on civilians as though they had different rules of engagement to the British ones. I mean, for example, in Nazariya, where the bridge was attacked by American soldiers trying to seize it, and there were certainly witnesses and British journalists saw truckloads of vanloads of Iraqi kids and women and civilians dead. And of course there was the famous incident in Najaf where the American soldier allegedly did not give warning shots. Anyway, whatever he did, he certainly shot up a vanload of Iraqi civilians. Now, the British think that they are right to think that they are slightly more cautious or have slightly stricter, let's say, rules of engagement. Then they talk about their Northern Ireland experience and their experience in peacekeeping and guerrilla warfare and all that stuff, and the fight for hearts and minds. And, you know, then you see pictures of British soldiers taking their helmets and berets off, talking to sort of grateful, smiling Iraqi kids around Basra, where the British are. And you don't see pictures like that with American Marines doing the same thing. Now, I can understand that because there's been a suicide bomb and so on. But there's a kind of contrast there, let's say.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that there is actually a schism between the British and American troops with regard to the rules of engagement?
I don't think it's a schism. I think there are different rules of engagement. I think there are different experience and different training, certainly. And it's a different sort of subculture, too. I wouldn't say it's a schism, but I think it's a cause of tension and irritation privately expressed to me and others, but obviously publicly British military commanders don't want to say anything about it because they say we're in a coalition, you know, with our allies, the Americans and so on. But certainly below the surface it is there and they talk about it. I mean, you know, it is easy to say, but I do think there is a difference in, well, I know there's a difference in training for this kind of unconventional warfare, if you like, and dealing with the local population in these places. And I think the Americans certainly have concern about, you know, their what is called force protection. For example, they don't even get out of their trucks, and when they do, they want to be covered in armor and helmets and wear shades and so on, whereas the British take off their, you know, don't wear. In fact, there's an order went out today, I think, with the British troops. When you're looking at Iraq, you take your sunglasses off, you know, eye-to-eye contact and all that stuff. That's the sort of difference, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is likely to happen to these three British soldiers that have been sent home?
Well, it's a very good question. I think the British authorities may want to let sleeping dogs lie, certainly until this war is over, at least the big battles are over. Then they might take action.
Mm-hmm.
Because they haven't officially said very much about what they did, it may be in the soldiers' interest to keep mum too and say nothing.
Did they actually refuse to fight?
They didn't refuse to fight because they weren't ever in that situation. It wasn't a situation, and I'm sure they wouldn't have done it. I mean, even if the Iraqi troops were around the corner, as it were, and they were attacked, they would have attacked them. I don't think that was the issue. I think the issue was the general one of why they're there in general terms and the justness or lack of it of the war, how it is being conducted, and so on.
Are these the only three that you know of? Of course, they were sent home, but have you gotten any indication that perhaps there are other British soldiers that may be feeling some of this as well?
No, not firsthand, because I'm not there now, but I think that I wouldn't be surprised, let's say, if a lot of this comes out at the end, i.e. a lot of dissatisfaction with the whole enterprise, really, and the morality of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no hard, direct evidence for that now.
Okay. Any final thoughts on your part, Richard?
You know, I think that for political reasons, really, the government here, and maybe in the U.S. too, but certainly here, gave the impression that it's going to be an easy war, that maybe it's on hope than expectation, really, but they put it about to a skeptical and a public opinion, you know, whose majority which is against the war, painted a picture of it's going to be, you know, as I say, very, very easy, that Saddam Hussein is completely unpopular dictator and everyone will come immediately to
throw flowers,
smiling and throw flowers at American and British troops. And that hasn't happened, as we know.
Okay.
And I think this kind of, you know, when you look in hindsight, I suppose, maybe it's an obvious thing. You have a sort of rotten army like the Iraqis do. You can't stop Americans and British soldiers in the desert, and you've got no air power at all. But you fight a guerrilla kind of warfare in the urban areas. And if that's dirty, that's dirty. That's the way it goes. You know?
Richard Norton Taylor, defense editor for the British newspaper The Guardian. The lack of critical coverage on the part of the mainstream U.S. media has prompted nationwide protests. Today, members of Code Pink held demonstrations outside the Fox News studios in Washington, D.C. and San Francisco to protest their coverage of the war in Iraq. The peace activists delivered, quote, pink slips, unquote, to reporters they felt were most biased and donated journalism textbooks to teach the basics of reporting. We spoke with Gail Murphy outside of the Fox News buildings in D.C.
We're here to remind Fox that according to their own motto, fair and balanced, they're not doing their job of fair and balanced coverage of the war in Iraq. And we're here to pink slip a few of their anchors and journalists, Geraldo, Holly Norris, Bill O'Reilly. And we're here to tell them that we want fair and balanced coverage of the war. We feel it's a disservice to the American people that that they are not telling the whole story up until the war and during the war.
Well, Geraldo was just expelled or escorted out of Baghdad because of the coverage that he was providing. Have you been keeping up with that report? And
well, I do know he was kicked out, and we don't want him there either because he's... even though he was supposedly telling secrets of the Pentagon, we feel that he's still acting as a megaphone for the Pentagon, and we really don't feel he's giving us good information.
Some have said that part of the sins of the media are that they are omitting key angles or stories or perspectives, and that the activists have not had a voice. What kind of effort have you made to actually be included in Fox's coverage?
Well, we have done actions in the street where, such as these, where we try to attract the media and have spokespersons on hand to be able to present our side. We've had our spokespeople on many programs, Fox, MSNBC, CNN. But we keep running into the same problem with Fox, is that they really want to attack the person and not stick to the issue.
Mm-hmm.
We feel that in presenting the complete story of the war, which they're not, they trot out the generals, the retired generals, and we don't hear from the anti-war people who have sound arguments against why this war is not justified. We feel that they're not investigating stories such as a forged document that the administration presented as a justification.
At the United Nations?
Well, this is the one that they claimed that Iraq had purchased uranium from Niger. And the CIA informed the White House that that was a forged document, yet they still used it as evidence. The Colin Powell's presentation at the UN in February, justifying the war, that the British government had put together a document based on a 12-year-old thesis student's work of abandoned papers found in Kuwait. We heard it on Democracy Now!, but most Americans aren't even aware of that. And so the journalists, so-called journalists in mainstream American media, are not doing their job of enlightening the public. It's a cornerstone to our democracy, and we need the information to make intelligent choices. I think if we had fair media, we wouldn't have such support for this war.
Mm-hmm. Not that it's your responsibility, but I'm just curious, has Code Pink ever issued press releases and distributed them to Fox and invited them to appear at your press events? Or
absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. In fact, we do know that people, we were in Baghdad, and we did actions and we did vigils there. And we informed Fox every day of what we were doing. And Fox occasionally showed up. And in fact, one Fox producer told us that he had done two stories on our activities in Baghdad, and they were cut once they arrived in the U.S. So producers might be willing, but the decision makers above them, the executive producers, are really managing what information Americans get.
Well, I understand that your protest today is, while we are speaking with you from a protest in Northwest Washington, that your protest actually extends nationwide?
That's correct. And we have put out a call to all of the Code Pink groups all over the United States to contact their local Fox affiliates and demand fair and unbiased reporting of the war.
Gail Murphy, Code Pink spokesperson. Several attempts to speak with a representative of Fox News for this report were not fruitful in time for this broadcast. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment. Mm-hmm.